Sciences Po.
So it's 9 a.m. I'm at the metro on Place de la Concorde in Paris. It's like 7 degrees and it's raining, and I'm wearing shorts. To be honest, I'm freezing. Right now, I'm walking up to the meetup point to join the Founders Running Club. From what I understand, it's a weekly thing for startup guys. We're supposed to run 5K at a conversational pace. I'm not sure what it means, but I guess I'll find out. Okay, here they are. Easy to spot them by the expensive gear. We have the sneakers, the tights, we have the smartwatches. Are you guys from the Founders Running Club? Cool, my name is Stanislav. I'm a journalist. I sent a message to the group chat. I don't know if you've seen. So I'm gonna run with you today. Hi, nice to meet you. So, not too early, 9:30 a.m. in the morning. Oh wow, on a Saturday. I'm not sure for whom this is a conversational pace, but definitely not for me. Hi guys, how are you? Good, it's fast pace for me, but...
The first time I run, like we run after it, we have a breakfast, and everyone was presenting their business, and I was like, oh shit, what am I gonna say?
Did you feel like, you were in Shark Tank?
Yes, exactly. This is what it feels like. They go, my name is na 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 na, and I founded this company of na 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 na.
So we're maybe like 50 people. Not bad for the weather, and I mean, it's Saturday morning. These people don't like sleeping in. I can't help but think, why do we do this to ourselves? Bad hour, frosty rain, and strangers. Every single thing here sounds like something I wouldn't like.
People have been running long distances at least since the OG Marathon man ran 42 kilometers to deliver news of a military victory. That was back in ancient Greece. The guy died right after, and since then we've been trying to do what he did. Now there's people that do it multiple times a year. We remember him so well because amid a collective struggle, a battle, he achieved a remarkable individual feat. It is the individual excellence, doing it solo, that made him immortal. Just look at the idioms that involve running. Running wild, to run like the wind, even run for office. They all express individual agency, freedom, lack of constraints. Hi, my name is Atoria, and just a second ago during the run, you heard my colleague Stash. In this episode, we look into the most primal and the most lonely of human sports, running. We ask ourselves, why ever since running became a sports trend in the 1970s, have we strived to turn it into a group activity? Why the most recent post-COVID running wave fueled running communities, both real and virtual? And why do we need the gaze and presence of others to simply jog? Stay with us as we talk to running clubs, historians, and sociologists, and find out how money, technology, and the burning need to be seen by the world propelled running to the huge popularity it enjoys today.
After my run, I talked to Vincent, one of the leaders of the Founders Running Club. He's a short South African man, exploding with energy. He worked in finance in Cape Town, moved to Paris for an MBA, and has run 3 startups. He's one of these people who you suspect can fit in more than 24 hours in a day. He stops the interview multiple times to chat to everyone and anyone. Everybody loves Vincent. I ask him, what's the idea behind the club?
Obviously, it's central to founders and tech creatives, as we call it, and investors. So it's like, how do we make founders connect with other founders, build good, strong, meaningful relationships, but at the same time, in an ecosystem type of way, where like the investors are there who come and pick up on really good ideas and are able to mobilize capital or ask the difficult questions to us founders who are building things for us to really think differently.
Vincent uses the expression community of like-minded people, which is a very nice way to say that Founders Running Club is essentially a networking space. People who come to the Saturday morning run want more than just break a sweat. They're on a mission to build something, as they like to say, or to get rich or die trying, to quote 50 Cent. And a half-hour jog is as much of the money-making scheme as any call or pitch.
Yes, I hate running, but like what it really comes from the running itself is so fruitful. And I find like I'll struggle with a problem the whole day, and then I run for 30 minutes and I've solved it, and I've come across with 5 different ideas around how to solve it.
So besides this clarity of mind that they achieve, why running? Think about it. It's a perfect match for startuppers, where you don't simply waste time for a social hangout. You optimize it. And the cult of performance, also sports performance, is at the very core of their entrepreneurial ideology. It is no accident that the startup world is the primary audience of the biohacking content. Besides, it's the perfect amount of social engagement. When you want to, you chat. When you don't, you just run. It's a community, but a community of people doing their own thing, on the trail, as in life. That's why Founders Running Club has enjoyed such huge popularity. Paris is by no means the only chapter. Around the world, there are clubs in 38 countries. There are more than 45,000 members of Founders Running Club worldwide. You heard that right, 45,000 startuppers who run together. Actually, business and running have much more in common than you might think. The modern running boom and the belief in the power and value of the individual that fuels the liberal mindset of today's world have the same sources in the crazy decade of 1970s.
It is a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul and spirit of our national will. We can see this crisis in the growing doubt about the meaning of our own lives and in the loss of a unity of purpose for our nation. Too many of us now tend to worship self-indulgence and consumption.
After the humiliation of the Vietnam War, the release of the Watergate files, and the oil crisis, Americans faced an uncertain political and economic future. They didn't want to build the common good they didn't necessarily believe in. So they turned to focusing on themselves. Personal growth and self-expression became a top priority. This newfound individualism showed itself in many ways. The interest in Eastern religions, new subcultures like punk rock and skateboarding, and, of course, the jogging craze. In the year 1970, there were 3 million runners in the USA. A decade later, 30 million. When running boomed in the 1970s, it was all about shaking off the shackles of social norms, running free wherever your legs could take you. George Sheehan, the author of the manifesto Running and Being, wrote this.
Running rid me of concern for the opinion of others, dispensed me from rules and regulations imposed from the outside. It stripped off those layers of programmed activity and thinking.
Consider running and the classic team sports. In football or basketball, there are countless rules. You're just one of many, and you're confined to a playing field. These sports represent the rigid social order of the 1950s. Running, piercing through the cities and suburbs, stood for the liberated, socially mobile order born out of the counterculture of the 1960s.
We both work in offices all day. Running helps us to unwind. We sleep better, we feel better, more alert. Running is now part of our life.
Look around. Everywhere you see people just like you getting the exercise they need and loving it. Get a checkup, then join them. In the long run, you'll be the winner.
What you just listened to is a 1978 running commercial by the President's Council on Physical Fitness and Sports. Back in the day, you got in your car, sat at work, and came back home for dinner. But now, after being stuck in the office all day, the middle class wanted out. They would not give into a routine without a little bit of freedom chasing.
Jogging, the latest American import and the latest enthusiasm.
We spoke with Dr. Aaron Haberman, a sports historian from the University of Northern Colorado. His research on running helped us make connections we hadn't previously considered. When we think of the American influence in the 70s, we think of hippies and surfers, not particularly runners. Yet runners of that era were part of the same cultural impulse, people searching for meaning, identity, or simply escape. This is why the Forrest Gump scene resonates so much. We often forget that his long, aimless run happens right after the Vietnam War, and he isn't doing it for a cause or a movement. He runs and he thinks about stuff. He's looking for meaning.
Damn.
Sir, why are you running?
Why are you running?
Are you doing this for world peace?
Are you doing this for the homeless?
Are you running for women's rights?
Or for the environment?
Or for animals?
They just couldn't believe that somebody would do all that running for no particular reason.
People just couldn't believe someone would run simply because they felt like it, which captures perfectly the mindset of many real-life runners of the time.
There's just all this uncertainty. And there have been people, again, in the 60s, on both the political right and the left, that have been questioning the sort of the status quo and certainly the counterculture in various ways. And so this, yeah, becomes a kind of, you know, running becomes a kind of countercultural activity that, at least initially, you're not doing what everybody else is doing, but you can build your own kind of community, like our, you know, punk rockers and skateboarders.
Aaron remembers that within the United States, there are already growing concerns over physical fitness. So this was something that more people needed to take seriously, particularly in the 1950s and early 1960s.
But the problem was is that most people kind of associated physical fitness with playing team sports, which was not often conducive for sort of middle-class adult lifestyles. An organization takes to create a basketball league or something like that, a team sport league, is just, you know, can be challenging. And so there was sort of a demand for something that could be a little more individual.
It functioned as kind of a belated counterculture movement for the American middle class. At the time, many people were searching for meaning, and this often took on a spiritual dimension. It was the 1970s, a decade marked by an explosion of new religious movements, and in some cases, dangerous cults like Jonestown and Heaven's Gate. This spiritual awakening that runners described was different. Instead of turning to extreme ideologies, they found a sense of purpose through a simple and arguably much healthier practice, using running as a way to understand themselves and regain control of their lives.
What really kind of surprised me when I got into the research was just how introspective the actual runners were at the time about what they were doing. They actually were thinking about, why am I doing this? And that's not always, you know, historians, you know, love when we find sources like that, because normally they don't, people don't always say exactly, we have to kind of intuit and interpret from other things they're saying. But the runners are actually pretty clear. You know, there's this great moment of, you know, when I'm testing myself physically and I'm breaking myself down, I can see who I am, and, you know, and I can build myself up, and I can see progress. Really talk about it in very kind of explicit terms like that.
James Fix, the author of the 1977 bestseller, The Complete Book of Running, talks about running as if it was a philosophy. You could even say religion.
Running, at its best, is a refuge from moral ambiguity. If you run 10 miles in 70 minutes, you know exactly what you have done and, equally to the point, what you have failed to do. If you stay in the assigned lane, you can be sure you have behaved as morally as any angel in heaven could ask. If you risk your supremacy by revealing to me how you run so well on the 110th Street hills, you have earned every right to take satisfaction in a deed untinged by base motives. Where else can we know with such wonderful certainty what the moral balance sheet looks like?
For runners, in a time when the nation's economic and geopolitical future was so uncertain, and with societal values constantly questioned, there existed a need to measure up, even if it revealed that you were not the best, or even mediocre.
I think it's much more performative today. Not that everyone who's running is simply performing. I think people are doing it for a lot of reasons, and, you know, and many of them, you know, legitimate. But I think, you know, the idea that I think there are many people that also want to be seen running.
To be seen running. I first came across the Marais Running Club while reading articles on the website of On, the Swiss running shoe brand that likes to position itself to sneakers what Apple is to computers. I already knew the brand. It's widely considered the go-to cool running shoe label.
So hot right now.
I had even joined an On-sponsored running group back when I lived in Rio. So naturally, I was curious to learn more about this Parisian club.
The running movement has its own chic drink. It's been a boon for models, sporting either the plastic look in jogging outerwear or the grease look.
Their Instagram immediately stood out. Grainy, analog-style photos and slightly blurred shots created by slow shutter speeds. It was undeniably pleasant to the eye, And when we spoke to them, they confirmed that the visual style was entirely intentional as well. And when you go on their website, it looks like it belongs to a fashion brand too. Or at least a creative agency.
We've met with three original members of the club at La Montgolfière, a luxury gym in the Parisian 10th district, where a membership costs a mercurial 200 euros per month. Wooden floors, marble tables, lots of fit, wealthy looking people. Arthur is a designer, Alban a product manager, and Valentin works in financial consulting. That's how the club came to be, according to Alban.
We were living in a big flat in the Marais, and we said, okay, maybe there is something to create. So we decided to set up a quick website, and we saw that, I mean, there was traction, there was people interested in it, and we said, okay, maybe there is a story to create, and we say, okay, now it's time to have a brand, time to communicate.
If you know Paris, that's kind of all you have to hear to get an idea of what this running club is about. Marais District is the fashion capital of the fashion capital of the world.
Oh la la.
It's tempting to say that a running trail in the Marais is a bit of a catwalk as well. And when you go on the website of the Marais Running Club, it does look like it belongs to a fashion brand, or at least a creative agency. Each post on the website looks like a new fashion campaign, and each event is done in cooperation with whatever running gear brand is hot right now. When the guys tell us that everyone is welcome to join, we take it with a grain of salt.
Are you not afraid of being perceived a little bit as exclusive?
Maybe yes, but it's also, I think, what we are looking for, because we don't want too many people at our runs. So for us, it's a part of Practice City, and also linked to our positioning to be maybe seen as a bit of an exclusive club, but it's okay for us.
In theory, running is the most accessible of sports. Just put on your shoes and run. Hell, some even do it barefoot. But as you can see by now, oftentimes to belong to running communities, you do best to fulfill a set of expectations, like having a certain dress code, frequenting certain districts, and focusing on performance and individual enhancement. You also have to have time to spend multiple hours per week just on a hobby. In short, most likely you belong to a particular social group, what back in the day they called young urban professionals, the Youpies. In France, these days you call the group Bobos. This has not changed since the 1970s. Now you have one more social code that you have to tackle if you want to be a full-fledged runner: Strava. Nowadays, everyone uses this omnipresent fitness app to log their runs, bike rides, or workouts. 70% of runners and cyclists track their performance, and a bulk of them use Strava to do so. Strava has another key feature. It is a social app. You add your friends, you see their runs, they see yours, you post photos of running together, and this is what skyrocketed Strava from 55 to 150 million users over the past 5 years. Guillaume Dietsch, a sociologist of sport at Paris Créteil University, has coined the term Generation Strava.
La génération de Strava, c'est aussi c'est une génération qui est en lien.
It's a generation that is constrained by time. There is a German philosopher named Harmut Rosa who talks about the acceleration of time. That is to say, young people are looking to optimize their time. So for example, when doing connected sports like running or cycling, they'll stay connected either through their app or by listening to podcasts, for example.
Soit sur leur application, mais aussi en écoutant des podcasts.
According to Dietsch, we optimize to avoid doing only one thing at a time. For some reason, it feels terribly wasteful. This multitasking is made much easier achieved with our phones. We can participate in a social dialogue on Strava, a portable running club. Sometimes, like with other stuff, the balance of real and virtual gets rather blurry.
En fait, ce qu'on observe, ce qui est observé
sur... In fact, what we observe, and what is also observed in the sociology of sport, is that there is a phenomenon of dependency. There's a phrase that's quite well known among Strava users: if it's not on Strava, it doesn't exist. So if it's really this idea that my activity, my sporting outing, is meaningless if I haven't shared my data.
Ma sortie sportive, si je n'ai pas partagé mes données.
Actually, it goes even further than what Guillaume Dietsch talks about. A French content creator has recently launched a website called Fake My Run, where a false GPS signal allows you to create a custom Strava post from the comfort of your own home. It's not only if it's not on Strava, it didn't happen, but also it happened because it's on Strava. Because Strava is a social platform dedicated to physical activity and bodily functions of their users. It has an impact that other social media don't. It establishes a relation with our body, especially with the help of connected devices such as smartwatches.
It has a direct impact on motivation and performance, but it's also a source of tension and can lead to certain excesses. Sometimes there has even been cheating on these applications, it has been proven, or sometimes precisely excessive exercise leads to mental health problems such as anxiety or even burnout after exercise. Like the society, sports practices, they are transforming precisely under the effect of new technologies. It means that in this Strava generation, we have amateur athletes who can no longer conceive of physical and sporting practice without being connected.
Un temps de pratique physique et sportive sans être connecté.
It is not a stretch to call Strava users a whole generation. The app has 150 million accounts, and in the beginning of 2025, 50 million users joined in just 4 months. You know that 150 million users is almost 2% of the world population? Now, adjust for the urban populations with internet and technology access, and you see that everyone is on Strava.
If I was able to push to my best effort, then usually I'm feeling pretty good and just like happy. There's like satisfaction, lots of big surges of dopamine, things like that. And then uploading it into Strava, usually I like to take like a night and then I look at it the next day. And it's almost like opening up this little present. I usually have my things private first, so I get to look at them first. And then, and then once you share it with the community, it can be cool to see people are celebrating like the effort. I would say it's like a little, like it's like the sprinkling on top of the cake.
The person you hear talking is Jasmine Lowther. Jasmine is a professional ultra trail runner, which means a person who runs ultra marathons on country trails. She has competed all over the world in 100-150 kilometer races. Well, she's essentially superhuman. Every month, she spends hundreds of hours on trail. It's a full-time job. But even she revels in doing a little Strava post, and she does that pretty much every day. Even for professional athletes, the sport in itself is not enough anymore. They also enjoy the technological upgrade we get when we let our device track our vitals. For Jasmine, Strava is many things. A coaching platform, a performance tracker, and a dating app? Have you met people that knew you or you knew them only from Strava?
Yeah, definitely. Even one of my exes, I fully met him through Strava.
Jasmine admits that she does not imagine herself stopping tracking her own vitals and performance, even after retiring from competitive sport. As an athlete, she's in full symbiosis with the devices she carries. But don't get it twisted. For her, this isn't just an app to connect with your peers and to give kudos. That's what you call likes on Strava. Ultra runners use Strava to size up before races.
So it's a bit like PR campaign.
Yeah, well, because some athletes, they'll go and do a very impressive workout. Like, Kilian Jornet is kind of famous for this. He'll go, I think it was before Western States, he did like a 50-mile time trial or something like that. It was very impressive. And people are like, oh, this person is very fit right now.
And people really keep up with Jasmine's performance. She's got fourth place at the World Mountain and Trail Running Championships, 81 kilometers this year. This is a big deal in the running world. And so she told us that when she's injured, she still logs her runs for herself, but doesn't share her workouts with her followers on Strava. Why? if they would see her running at a slower pace or do too many chill biking sessions, people will literally go to her DMs to ask her about it.
People will reach out. They will reach out and they say like, oh, are you injured? Oh, are you doing this race? And it goes into like your competitors will be like, oh, Jasmine's injured. And that gives them some extra confidence going into, say, if you are lining up at the same race as them in a few months.
I like to run by myself. Fast and far.
I'm free. I like how it feels.
To push myself.
To try things I think I can't do.
To break my own records. Because it makes me feel
alive.
I like to run by myself.
But even when I do, I know.
I'm never alone.
What you just listened to is a recent Strava ad. What it seems to say is that when running, you're never truly alone. It's a reassuring vision, but it gets a bit creepy when you think about the fact that this companion they mean is just sitting in your pocket. Thaddeus Kostrubala, author of the 70s book The Joy of Running, said that one of the basic ideas about running a marathon is that ultimately, everyone needs to run this race alone. He says that it's a unique celebration of individuality. So, where does this shift come from? Why do we not want to battle the distance by ourselves anymore? We consulted Dr. Jack Black, a sports psychoanalyst, who told us the following anecdote about a paper he wrote.
We looked at an ultramarathon runner who does the Marathon de Sable, which is where they run across the sort of Sahara Desert for like 22 hours straight. That was done with colleagues at the institution where I work. What was quite interesting was one of them actually did it. And what we found out in the staff room one day was he kept a diary while he did it.
So what was in the diary?
Death. It was full of death. He was running through, obviously, the Sahara Desert, and there was so much contemplation on death in the diary, which we found to be really interesting.
Let's go back to the Greek marathon man. He made the distance, but he died right after. Running, especially long-distance running, is exactly that. We struggle against our bodies, and it feels like a matter of life and death. Compare this with Jasmine's bubbliness about sharing her training with followers and her excitement at logging her runs on Strava, even though she runs the most murderous ultra marathons. Maybe she's invincible like that, but maybe being constantly connected changes why we run and what we feel during the run. So, speaking in philosophical terms, what is Strava to us? Strava is the big other, to use the idea of the French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan. The big other is an anonymous authority looming over us that comes from what society or religion tell us. Essentially, the big other is everyone else and what they think. The promise of liberation through running is that we do it alone. Just us and the path. But with Strava, we carry the big other in our pockets, or on our wrists, or even on our fingers. Our devices watch over us, telling us to feel good when we do something desired, like a fast or a long run, and we feel scolded by them when we see that the results are not good. Here's how Irina from the Founders Running Club spoke about her Aura Ring, a connected tracking device you wear on your finger that has become really popular lately.
Aura Ring gets you a score, a sleeping score, and so I'm very competitive, and I wanted to get a good score. I wanted to be like 100 out of 100. But eventually Aura was giving me like something like 60. And I was like, that's bad. I'm frustrated about it. And so I was trying to improve my grades. And I was putting pressure on myself. But now I'm fine. So eventually, after 2 years.
It's like nowadays, we feel lost without the eye looking over us. Our interviewers admitted that they feel more comfortable being tracked than not. Here's Vincent from Founders Running Club talking about his Habits app.
How does it make you feel when you log something on Strava or when you check that you've done a habit on your habit tracker?
Ah, it's so good. He's the spot.
it hits the spot. I think it's like it's achievement. And hitting all of them even better, like even better. It barely happens, but in the times when it has happened, the app does like this confetti celebration. And I'm just like, mama, I made it. I love that.
Even Jasmine, a professional athlete who wins actual medals, says that getting an achievement on Strava is like this extra carrot.
I do love the Strava crowns, and I personally, I feed off of that. It's just like an extra carrot out there, so.
Since I was a kid, I always ran with my dad. He's an extra athlete and part of that big wave in the 90s of individual sports, when running, cycling, and fitness exploded. At a time, there were no apps, no segments, no data, just breathing, talking, and sharing a road together. Because of this habit, when I was around 13, I joined the cross-country team at school, and suddenly I found a community. Some of my closest friendships at the time were born during those after-school runs or during the weekend 6 a.m. practices where we all ate breakfast together. Running became addictive, not just because of the endorphins or the sense of progress, but because of the people, the shared suffering, and the almost religious rhythm of training multiple times a week. And even though Strava wasn't huge yet back then, we were already living inside the mindset that Guillaume Dietsch described in the interview. We didn't have so much of that digital extremity yet, the craving to post our runs, but we had the same impulse, tracking everything, comparing times, studying old records, dreaming of beating ghosts from past seasons. In a way, we were a pre-Strava version of the Strava generation. There was also the cult of performance that Dietsch talks about, this idea that you're supposed to always optimize, always improve, always push past your limit. I remember coaches yelling up the hill, push until you think you're about to die. That's when progress starts. That's when running starts to feel good. And honestly, they weren't entirely wrong. That feeling of breaking that threshold was incredible, and it still is. I will never forget a summer where, obsessed with hitting my best time for the next season, I kept training despite an ankle injury from track and field. I didn't have dreams of becoming a pro athlete, but I really trained past my limit. I did physio while still following my summer running plan religiously. The pain didn't matter, the progress did, until it didn't. From ankle problems, to then knee issues, to malnutrition and exhaustion, my body finally shut down. At 15, I hit a full-on burnout. Doctors told me I needed to rest, eat better, sleep better, breathe. Listening to Dietsch now, 10 years later, made me realize that my story wasn't just a personal collapse. It was a small version of something much larger. I burned out before the hyper-connected era, where amateurs and professionals face even more pressure. Everything is quantified, shared, compared, public. This hyper-connectivity creates its own kind of dependence. Maybe that's why now, even though I'm much healthier in my head, I'm almost allergic to fitness apps. I don't post on Strava. I don't really track a lot of my runs. In a weird way, I think I'm trying to escape the big other, the invisible audience that now accompanies so many sports practices. I still love running though. I joined a running club back when I lived in Rio, and it was great to discover so many running clubs in Paris, to get a sense of a running community I hadn't seen in a while. We got a unique look into how Generation Strava spends time together. In the era of sedentary lifestyles, civilizational diseases, and doom scrolling, it's really good that sport has become something that connects many of us, and even a trend. According to a survey done by Strava, nearly 1 in 5 Gen Z users went on a date with someone they met through exercise, and were 4 times more likely to want to meet people through working out rather than at the bar. Combine it with the fact that members of this generation are less hooked on alcohol than their parents, and suddenly, it seems we're not all that doomed. But the whole point of Generation Strava is that technology and liberalism profoundly transform the way we do sports. On one hand, we jump at the opportunity of being connected to our friends, even when we fight a very intimate battle, the one against our own limitations. It feels easier this way. On the other, we tend to pick individual sports over group sports because we can control how involved in the community we are. The success of others does not depend on us. We're not part of the team. As Aaron Haberman put it, we're solitary runners that come together.